gallant heart and sharp wits, Tiron feared for the safety of the crow, and feared still more for Gwydion's quest. And to him came the foreboding that an even heavier fate might ride on Kor's outspread wings. It had been agreed that when the travellers neared Great Averon, King Rune would escort the disgruntled Glew to the ship anchored in the river, there to await his return, for Rune was determined to ride with Gwydion to Caer Cadarn. Glew liked neither cooling his heels on the swaying vessel, nor sleeping on the hard pebbles of the shore. But the protests of the former giant could not move the King of Mona to change his plan. While Gwydion held a last, hurried council with Dalban, the companions began leading the horses from the stable. The wise Melengar, Gwydion's white, golden-maned steed, waited calmly for her master. Melenlas, Taran's stallion, snorted and impatiently pawed the ground. Ailanwy was already mounted on her favourite, the bay mare Luagor. In a fold of her cloak, the princess carried her most treasured possession, the golden sphere that glowed brightly when she cupped it in her hands.
"I'm leaving that uncomfortable crown behind," Ailanwy declared. "There's no use for it at all, except to hold down your hair, and that's hardly worth the blisters. But I'd sooner walk on my hands than go without my bauble. Besides, if we need a light, we shall have one. That's much more practical than a hoop on top of your head."
In a saddlebag, she had packed the embroidery made for Taran, intending to finish it along the way.
"Perhaps," Ailanwy added, "I might fix the colour of Henwen's eyes while I'm at it."
Fluda's mount was the huge, tawny cat, Lian, herself tall as a horse. Seeing the bard, she purred loudly, and Fluda could barely keep the powerful animal from knocking him down with her nuzzling.
"Gently, old girl," cried the bard, as Lian thrust her great head between his neck and shoulder. "I know you want a tune on my harp. I shall play one later, I promise you."
Glew had recognized Lian immediately.
"That's not fair," he sniffed. "By all rights, she belongs to me."
"Yes," replied Fluda, "if you count feeding her those vile potions you once brewed to make her grow bigger. If you care to ride her, you're welcome to try. Though I warn you, Lian has a memory longer than her tail."
Lian, indeed, had begun lashing her tail at the sight of Glew. She towered over the pudgy little man, her yellow eyes blazed, her whiskers twitched, her tufted ears went flat against her head, and from her throat came a sound quite unlike her greeting to the bard. Fluda quickly strummed a melody on his harp. Lian turned her eyes from Glew, and her mouth curved in an enormous smile, and she blinked fondly at the bard. However, Glew's pale face had gone paler, and he edged away from the cat.
"When I was a giant," Glew muttered, "things were considerably better managed."
King Rune saddled his dapple-grey steed. Since Carl, who had also decided to accompany Gwydion, would ride the sorrel mare Lamorai, foal of Melenlas and Luagor, Glew had no choice but to climb up behind Gurgi on his shaggy pony, a companionship unwelcome to all three. Taran, meanwhile, helped Carl rummage in the stables, forge and tool sheds for weapons.
"Few enough of them there are," said Carl. "These spears have served me well as bean poles," the stout warrior added. "I had hoped never to use them for another purpose. Alas, the only blade I can give Gwydion is rusted from propping up one of the apple trees. As for helmets, there are none save my leather cap. And the sparrows have a nest in it. I shall not disturb them. But my own old pate is tough as leather," Carl said, winking. "It can last me to Caer Cadarn and back." "And you, my lad," Carl went on cheerfully, though he had not failed to notice Taran's troubled frown. "I remember a day when an assistant pig-keeper would have been all flash and fire to ride with Lord Gwydion. Now you look as glum as a frost-bitten turnip."
Taran smiled. "I myself would ride to Anuvin if Gwydion allowed me. What you say is true, old friend. For the boy I was, this would have been a bold adventure, full of glory. This much have I learned. A man's life weighs more than glory, and a price paid in blood is a heavy reckoning." "My heart is not easy," Taran added. "Long ago you made your way to Anuvin to rescue Henwen after she had been stolen from you. Tell me, What chance has Gwydion alone in Arawn's realm?
No man has better,
said Carl, shouldering the spears. And he was gone from the shed before Taran realized the old warrior had not really answered him at all. Caer Dalban lay far behind them, and the day was darkening when the companions made camp deep in the shadows of the forest. Ailanwy happily flung herself to the ground.
"It's been long since I've slept on comfortable roots and rocks," she cried. "What a pleasant change from goose feathers!"
Gwydion allowed a fire to be built, and while Carl sorted the mounts, Gurgi opened his wallet of food to share out provisions. For the most part, the companions were silent, chilled, and stiff after the long day's journey. King Rune, however, had lost none of his good spirits. As the travellers huddled closer to the pale flames, Rune picked up a twig and scratched busily in the earth, covering the ground before him with a spider-web of lines.
"About that seawall," said Rune. "I think I see how it went wrong. Yes, exactly so. Now here's the way to do it."
From across the fire, Taran saw Rune's eyes brightly eager, and on his face the familiar boyish grin. But Rune, Taran sensed, was no longer the feckless princeling he had known on the Isle of Mona. As Rune was absorbed in the tasks he had planned, so Taran had been caught up in his own labours at forge, loom, and potter's wheel. And if Rune had found manhood in ruling a kingdom, Taran had found the same in toiling among the staunch folk of the Free Comets. He watched Rune with new affection. The King of Mona spoke on, and Taran's interest was drawn to the scratchings on the ground. He studied them as Rune continued. Taran smiled. One thing had not changed, he realized. As usual, the King of Mona's intentions went somewhat beyond the King of Mona's skill. "I fear your wall may tumble if you build it thus," Taran said with a kindly laugh.
"See this part here," he pointed. "The heavier stones must be sunk deeper. And here—"
"Amazing!" exclaimed Rune, snapping his fingers. "Quite right! You shall come to Mona and help me finish it."
He began scratching new lines so vigorously he nearly pitched himself headlong into the fire.
"Oh, great and kindly master," cried Gurgi,
who had been listening closely without altogether understanding what the two comrades had been discussing.
"Oh, clever scannings and plannings! Gurgi wishes he, too, had wisdom of wise speakings."
Gwydion warned them to silence.
"Our fire is risk enough, without adding noise to it. I can only hope Arawn's huntsmen are not abroad. We are too few to withstand even a handful of them. They are not common warriors," Gwydion added, seeing Rune's questioning expression, "but an evil brotherhood. Slay one of their band, and the strength of the others grows that much greater."
Taran nodded. "They are as much to be feared as the Cauldronborn," he cautioned Rune, "the deathless, voiceless creatures that guard Anuvin. Perhaps more to be feared. The Cauldronborn cannot be slain, yet their power dwindles if they journey too far or stay too long beyond Arawn's realm." Rune blinked and Gurgi fell silent, glancing behind him uncomfortably. Memory of the ruthless Cauldronborn turned Taran's thoughts once more to Henwen's prophecy. "The flame of Durnwin quenched," Taran murmured. "Yet how shall Arawn achieve this? For all his power, I will not believe he can even draw the blade."
"Prophecy is more than words that shape it," Gwydion said. "Seek the meaning that underlies it. For us, the flame of Durnwin will be as good as quenched if Arawn keeps it from my hands. Its power will indeed vanish, for all it may avail us should the blade be locked forever in his treasure hoard."
"Treasure?"
said Glew, stopping his munching only long enough to speak the word.
"The Death Lord's domain is as much a treasure house as a stronghold of evil," Gwydion said. "Long has it been filled with all the fair and useful things Arawn has stolen from Prydain. These treasures do not serve him. His purpose is to deprive, to keep their use from men, to sap our strength by denying us what might yield a richer harvest than any of us here has known."
Gwydion paused.
"Is this not death in but another guise?"
"I have been told," Taran said, "the treasure troves of Anuvin hold all that men could wish for. Ploughs there are said to be, that work of themselves, scythes that reap with no hand to guide them, magical tools, and more, Taran went on. For Aron stole the craft secrets of metalsmiths and potters, the lore of herdsmen and farmers. This knowledge, too, lies locked forever in his hoard. Glue sucked his teeth. The morsel of food stayed untouched in his chubby fingers. For a long while he said nothing. At last he cleared his throat.
I mean to forgive your slights and humiliations. It would not have happened when I was a giant, I assure you. But no matter, I pardon you all. In token of my goodwill, I too shall journey with you.
Gwydion looked at him sharply. Perhaps you shall, he said quietly after a time.
No question of it now, Fluda snorted. The little weasel hopes to sniff out something for himself. I can see his nose trembling. I never thought the day would come when I should want him at our side. But I think that's safer than having him at our backs.
Glue smiled blandly.
I forgive you, too, he said.
Chapter 4 King Smoit's Castle. At dawn, King Rune made ready to part from the companions and ride farther westward to Averyn Harbour, where he would advise his shipmaster of the change in plans. Fluda was to accompany him, for the bard knew the shallow fording places across the river and the swiftest paths on the opposite bank. Ailanwy had decided to go with them.
I've forgotten half my embroidery thread in Rune's ship, and must have it if I'm to finish Henwen properly. Neither of you can find it, for I'm not sure myself where it might be. I believe I've left a warmer travelling cloak, too, and a few other things. I don't remember what they are right now, but I'm bound to think of them once I get there.
Carl grinned and rubbed his bald crown.
The princess, he remarked, becomes more the lady in every way.
Since I'm not staying on the ship, said Glue,
whose decision of the night before remained unshaken,
I see no reason to be taken out of my way. I shall follow with Lord Gwydion.
That, my puny giant, is where you're wrong, the bard replied. Mount up behind the King of Mona, if he can stand your company, and be quick about it. Don't think I'll let you out of my sight for a moment. Where I go, you go. And the other way around, too, for the matter of that.
Surely, Fluda, Taran said, drawing the bard aside, Glue can't trouble us. I myself shall watch over him. The bard shook his tousled yellow head.
No, my friend. I'll be easier in my mind if I see him with my own eyes, and at all times. No, the little weasel is in my charge. Ride on ahead, and we'll catch up with you on the other side of Averyn well before midday. I'll be glad to see Smoit again, Fluda added. That red-bearded old bear is dear to my heart. We shall feast well at Caer Cadarn, for Smoit eats as bravely as he fights.
Gwydion had already mounted Melengar and signalled them to hasten. Fluda clapped Taran on the shoulder and ran to climb astride Lian, who was frisking gaily in the bright, cold sun and pouncing at the tip of her own tail. King Rune, Fluda, Ailanwy, and Glue soon were out of sight. Bearing westward, Taran rode between Gwydion and Carl, while Gergi on his pony trotted at the rear. They halted on the far bank of Great Averyn. Midday passed without a sign of the other companions. Though Taran was anxious about them, he preferred to believe they had not come to harm. Rune has likely stopped to look at a badger tunnel or anthill, he said. I hope it is no more than that.
Never fear, said Carl. Fluda will jog him along. They'll be here at any moment.
Taran sounded his horn, hoping the signal would guide the bard in case Fluda had mistaken the path. Still, they did not come. Gwydion, having waited as long as he dared, chose to press on to Caer Cadarn. They continued at a brisk pace for the rest of the day. Taran turned often in his saddle, expecting always to glimpse Rune and the other companions galloping up behind them, or suddenly to hear the King of Mona's cheerful, "Hello! Hello!" However, as the day waned, Taran realized that Rune, a slow horseman at best, was by now outdistanced. Fluda, he was sure, would not travel after nightfall.
"'They have camped somewhere behind us,' Carl assured Taran. "'Were aught amiss, one of them would have reached us. "'Fluda Flam knows the way to Smoit's castle. "'We shall all meet there. "'And if they seem too long delayed, Smoit will raise a searching party.'
The stout warrior put a hand on Taran's shoulder.
"'Ease your spirit until there is clear cause for alarm. "'Or,' he added with a wink, "'is it the company of Princess Ailanwy you long for?'
"'She should not have come with us,' Taran replied, half angrily.
"'No doubt,' Carl grinned. "'Yet you were not the one to speak against her.'
Taran grinned back at him. "'As for doing that,' he said, "'I have given it up long since.' At mid-morning of the following day, Caer Cadarn rose before them, and from a stone tower Smoit's crimson banner with its emblem of a black bear snapped in the wind. The stronghold had been built in a clearing, and the heavy walls jutted like the bearded king's own brows, scarred and pitted by many a battle. Carl, urging Lamrai ahead, shouted to the guards in the name of Gwydion, Prince of Don. The massive gates opened, and the companions galloped into the courtyard, where men-at-arms tethered the horses, and a party of warriors led the way to Smoit's great hall. Gwydion strode quickly down the corridor. Flanked by the guards, Taran, Carl, and Gurgi followed. "'Smoit will be at his meat,' Taran said. "'His breakfast lasts till high noon,' he laughed. "'He says it whets his appetite for the rest of his meals.' Gwydion will get no word out of him until we ourselves are stuffed.
"'Yes, yes!' Gurgi cried. "'Gurgi longs for tasty crunchings and munchings.'
"'You shall have them, old friend,' Taran answered. "'Be sure of it.' They entered the great hall. At one end stood Smoit's huge throne, cut from half an oak tree and carved in the shape of a bear, with paws upraised on either side. The man seated there was not King Smoit.
"Mag!"
Taran gasped. Guards fell upon them instantly. Taran's sword was ripped from his belt. With a great cry, Gwydion flung himself against the warriors, but they pressed about him and bore the Prince of Don to his knees. Carl, too, was borne down, and a spear pressed against his back. Gurgi yelled in rage and terror. A guard seized him by the scruff of his shaggy neck, buffeting him until the poor creature could barely stagger to his feet. Mag grinned like a skull. With a slight movement of his skinny fingers, he gestured the warriors to stand away. His grey, pinched face twitched with pleasure.
"'Our meeting, Lord Gwydion, is one I did not foresee. My warriors hold Caer Cadarn, but this is an added prize, and a richer one than I had hoped.'
Gwydion's green eyes blazed.
"'Have you dared even to enter King Smoit Cantrev? "'Begone from here before he returns. "'He shall deal with you less gently than I.'
"'You will join King Smoit,' Mag replied. "'Though king I scorn to call this rude Cantrev lord.'
Mag's thin lips curled. Caressingly he put a hand to his embroidered cloak. Taran saw that Mag's garments were even richer than those the lank-haired man had worn as chief steward to the court of Mona.
"'More powerful than Smoit, or the king of Mona, more powerful than Queen Akron is my liege lord,' Mag said with a yellow smile, "'and mightier now than the Prince of Don.'
He touched the iron chain hanging from his neck and fondled the heavy badge of office. In horror, Taran saw it bore the same symbol that was branded on the foreheads of the huntsmen.
"'I serve no less a liege,' Mag said haughtily, "'than the king of Anuvin, Aron, Death Lord himself.'
Gwydion's glance did not falter.
"'You have found your true master, Mag.'
"'When last we parted, Lord Gwydion,' said Mag, I believed you dead. It was my joy later to learn that you were not.
The chief steward licked his lips.
Seldom is one given to savour his revenge twice, and I was patient until the day we should meet again.
Patient,
Yes, Mag hissed. Long I wandered after I sailed from the Isle of Mona. There were those I served humbly, biding my time. One sought even to cast me in a dungeon. I, Mag, who once held a kingdom in his grasp.
The voice of the chief steward rose shrilly. His face had gone livid, and his eyes started from their sockets. But in a moment he gained control of his trembling hands, and sank back on Smite's throne. Now the words came from his lips, as if he were tasting each one.
At length, I made my way to Anuvin, Mag said, to the very threshold of Dark Gate. Lord Aron did not know me then, as he knows me now.
Mag nodded in satisfaction.
There was much he learned from me.
Lord Aron knew the history of Durnwin, Mag continued. He knew it had been lost and found again, and that Gwydion, son of Don, bore it. But it was I, Mag, who told him how best to gain it.
Even your treachery is paltry, Taran said. Late or soon, with or without you, Aron would have struck on that evil scheme himself.
Perhaps, Mag said slyly. Perhaps what he learned from me was less than what I learned from him. For I soon discovered that his power was dangerously balanced. His champion, the Horned King, had long been defeated. Even the Black Crocken, the cauldron that gave him the deathless Cauldronborn, was shattered. Lord Aron has many secret liegemen among the Cantre of Kings, Mag went on. He has promised them great riches and domains, and they are sworn to serve him. But his defeats turned them restive. It was I who showed him the means to win stronger allegiance. It was my plan, mine alone, that put Durnwin in his hands. Word now spreads throughout the Cantrevs that Aron Deathlord holds the mightiest weapon in Prydaine. He knows its secrets far better than you do, Lord Gwydion, and knows he cannot be defeated. His liegemen rejoice, for they will soon taste victory. Other warlords will rally to his banner, and his host of warriors will grow. I, Mag, have wrought this, the chief steward cried. I, Mag, second only to the Death Lord. I, Mag, speak in his name. I am his trusted emissary, and I ride from realm to realm, gathering armies to destroy the sons of Don and those who give them allegiance. All Prydaine will be his dominion, and those who stand against him, if Lord Aron chooses to be merciful, he will slay them. His huntsmen will drink their blood. The others will grovel in bondage forever.
Mag's eyes gleamed, his pale brow glistened, and his cheeks quivered violently.
For this, he hissed, for this, Lord Aron has sworn to me by every oath. One day I, Mag, will wear the iron crown of Anuvin.
You are as much a fool as a traitor, Gwydion said in a hard voice. And doubly so, first to believe Aron, then to believe King Smite would heed your serpent's words. Have you slain him? Only dead would he listen to you.
Smite lives, answered Mag. I care nothing for his allegiance. I seek the fealty of the liegemen in his Cantrev. Smite shall order them in his name to serve my cause.
King Smite would sooner have his tongue ripped out, Taran cried.
And so perhaps he shall, replied Mag. Mute, he will serve me as well. He will ride with me, and I will speak on his behalf better than he would speak on his own.
Yet, he mused, I would prefer the commands to come from his lips rather than mine. There are ways to loosen his tongue instead of cutting it from his head. Some have already been tried.
Mag narrowed his eyes.
The best means stand before me now. You, Lord Gwydion, and you, Pig Keeper. Speak with him. Let Smite see that he must yield to me.
Mag smiled crookedly. Your lives hang on it. The chief steward moved his head slightly. The guards stepped forward. Roughly, the companions were prodded from the great hall. Shock and despair so filled Taran that he was hardly aware of the passages they were led down. The warriors halted. One flung open a heavy door. Others thrust the companions into a narrow chamber. The door grated shut, and darkness swallowed them. As they groped blindly, Taran stumbled on a prostrate form that stirred and bellowed loudly.
"My body and blood!"
roared the voice of King Smite, and Taran was grappled by a pair of bone-cracking arms.
"Are you come again, Mag? You'll not take me alive!"
Taran was nearly smothered and crushed before Gwydion called out his own name and the names of the companions. Smoyt's grip loosened, and Taran felt a huge hand on his face.
"My pulse, and so it is,"
cried Smoyt as the companions gathered around him.
"The Big Keeper, Lord Gwydion, Carl, I'd know that bald pate of yours anywhere."
His hands fell on Gurgi's dishevelled head.
"And the little, whatever it is. Well met, my friends."
Smoyt groaned heavily.
"And ill met, too. How has that simpering sop trapped you? The lard-lipped, squirming lackey has snared us all."
Gwydion quickly told Smoyt what had befallen them. The red-bearded king growled furiously.
"Mag caught me as easily as he did you. Yesterday I was at breakfast, and had barely set myself to my meat when my steward brought tidings that a messenger from Lord Gorion sought words with me. Now then, I knew Gorion was at odds with Lord Ghast, a matter of cow-stealing as usual. Ah, will the Cantrev lords of Prydain ever stop their endless bickering? However, since I'd heard Ghast's side of it, I deemed I should listen to Gorion's."
Smoyt snorted and struck his massive thigh.
"Before I could swallow another mouthful, Mag's warriors were about me. My heart and liver, some of them will remember Smoyt. Another troop had lain in ambush and stormed through the gate."
Smoyt put his head in his hands.
"Of my own men, those not slain are prisoned in the guard rooms and armouries."
"And you?" Taran asked anxiously. "Are you in pain? Mag spoke of torture."
"Pain?"
Smoyt bellowed so loudly the chamber echoed.
"Torture? I suffer till I sweat, but not at the hands of that long-nosed worm. My skin's thick enough. Let Mag break his teeth on my bones. He troubles me no more than a flea-bite or bramble-scratch. Why, I've taken worse in a friendly scuffle." "Do you speak of pain?"
Smoyt stormed on.
"By every hair of my beard, I swear it pains me more than hot iron to be mewed up in my own castle. My own stronghold, and a captive in it. Gulled in my own great hall. My own food and drink snatched from my lips, and my breakfast ruined. Torment? Worse than that, it's enough to sour a man out of his appetite."
Gwydion and Carl, meantime, had made their way to the walls, and, as far as the dim light allowed, were hastily examining them for any sign of weakness. Taran, now that his eyes had grown a little more used to the gloom, feared that his companions were wasting their labours. The cell was windowless. What little air reached them came only from the tiny, heavily barred grating of the door. The floor was not of hard-packed earth, but of flagstones joined with barely a crack. Smoyt himself, realizing the purpose of Gwydion's efforts, shook his head and pounded his iron-shod boots on the floor.
"Solid as a mountain," he cried. "I know, for I built it myself. Spare yourself pains, my friends. It will crack no sooner than I."
"How far below ground is this dungeon?" Taran asked, though his hope for escape was fading with each moment. "Is there no way we can dig upward?"
"Dungeon?" cried Smoyt. "I've no more dungeons in Kaer Kadan. When last we met, you called my dungeons useless. Right you were, and so I walled them up. Now there's no wrongdoing in my cantrev that I can't settle quicker and easier with a few words. who hears my voice will mend his ways, or mend his head. Dungeon, indeed! It's a spare larder! Would that I stocked it as solidly as I built it, groaned Smite. Let Mag bring his irons and lashes. I'll heed them not a bit in the midst of this other fiendish torment. The larder lies beside my scullery. I've not lined my belly for 2 days. 2 years, it feels. The vile traitor has not left off his feasting, and for me, no more than the sniff of it. Oh, he shall pay for this, Smite cried. I'll beg him one thing only. A moment with my paws about his skinny neck. I'll squeeze out all the puddings and pastries he's ever gobbled.
Gwydion had come to crouch beside the furious Smite. Your larder may be our tomb, he said grimly. Not only for ourselves, he added. Fluda Flam leads our companions here. Mag's jaws will close on them as tightly as they are closed on us. Chapter 5 The Watcher. Although Fluda Flam quickly led Ilanwi, King Rune, and Glu to Avern Harbour, their return from the ship was less rapid. First, the King of Mona managed, against all likelihood, to tumble over his horse's neck when the Dapple Grey halted to drink at the riverbank. The ducking thoroughly soaked the unlucky king, but did not dampen his spirits. However, Rune's sword belt had come undone, and the blade had sunk in the shallows. Rune, being unable to fish it out again because he had also got himself tangled in the steed's harness, Fluda was obliged to plunge into the river for the weapon. Glu now protested bitterly against riding behind the sopping king.
"Walk, then, little weasel,"
cried Fluda, shivering and beating his arms against his sides.
"By my choice, in the opposite direction."
Glu only sniffed haughtily and refused to budge. Ilanwi stamped her foot with impatience.
"Will you make haste, all of you? We came to look after Lord Gwydion, and we can hardly look after ourselves."
The former giant consented to ride behind the princess on Wagor, and they set out once more. Lian, however, had suddenly taken it into her head to be playful. She lunged forward on her huge padded paws and spun joyfully about while the desperate bard clung to her tawny neck. It was all Fluda could do to keep Lian from rolling onto her back with himself astride her.
"She seldom does this,"
shouted the breathless bard, while Lian, with great leaps, circled the companions.
"She's really been quite well behaved. No use scolding her. Makes no difference."
At last Fluda was forced, with difficulty, to unsling his harp and pluck out a melody until Lian grew calm again. Soon after midday the bard heard the faint, distant notes of Taran's horn.
"They're worried over us," Fluda said. "I hope we shall soon rejoin them."
The companions pressed on as quickly as they could, but the distance between the two bands increased rather than dwindled, and at nightfall they wearily halted and slept. A fresh morning start brought them, according to Fluda's reckoning, less than half a day behind the others. King Rune, more than ever eager to reach Caer Cadarn, urged all speed from the Dapple Grey. But the mare's pace was much slower than Lian's and Luago's. Ilanwi and Fluda continually had to rein in their mounts. Midway through the afternoon, King Rune gave a glad cry. Caer Cadarn lay only a little distance off. They saw Smoit's crimson banner clearly beyond the trees. The companions were about to hasten onward, but Ilanwi frowned and looked once more at the fluttering standard.
"How odd," the princess remarked. "I see King Smoit's jolly old bear, but Gwydion surely must be there by now, and I don't see the banner of the House of Don. Queen Teleria taught me it is courtesy for a Cantrev noble to fly the golden sunburst of Don when one of the royal house visits him."
"True enough in ordinary circumstances," agreed Fluda, "but I doubt, at this point, that Gwydion wants anyone to know where he is. He's told Smoit to put aside the formalities, a most sensible precaution."
"Yes, of course," Ilanwi replied. "I shouldn't have thought of that. How clever of you, Fluda."
The bard beamed happily.
experience, Princess, long experience. But never fear, such wisdom will come to you in time.
Even so, Ailanwy said as they rode farther, it's curious the gates are closed. Knowing King Smite, you might suppose they'd be flung wide open, and a guard of honour waiting for us, with King Smite himself at their head.
Fluda waved the girl's remark aside.
Not a bit of it. Lord Gwydion follows a path of danger, not a round of festivals. I understand how such things are done. I've been on 1,000 secret missions. Ah, well, perhaps 1 or 2, he added hastily. I fully expected Caer Cadarn would be buckled, bolted, and shut tight as an oyster.
Yes, Ailanwy said. I'm sure you know more about such things than I.
She hesitated, straining her eyes to take in the castle, which the companions were now rapidly approaching.
But King Smite isn't at war with his neighbours, as far as I've heard. 2 watchmen on the walls would be more than enough. Does he need a whole party of bowmen?
Naturally, replied Fluda, to protect Lord Gwydion.
But if no one is to know Gwydion's there, Ailanwy persisted.
Great Berlin, cried the bard, reining up Lian. Now you make my head spin. Are you trying to say Gwydion's not at Caer Cadarn? If he's not, we shall soon find out. And if he is, we shall find out that as well.
Fluda scratched his spiky yellow head.
But if he's not, then why not? What could have happened? And if he is, then there's nothing to worry about. Yet if he isn't... Oh, drat and blast! You've turned me queasy. I don't understand.
I don't understand either, Ailanwy answered. All I know, and I don't even know it, is that, well, I can't explain. I see the castle all crooked-wise. No, not see. Taste? No, well, no matter, she burst out. I've come all over chills and creeps, and I don't like it. You've had experience, I don't doubt, but my ancestors were enchantresses, every one, and so should I have been if I hadn't chosen to be a young lady.
Enchantments, the bard muttered uncomfortably. Stay away from them. Don't meddle. It's also been my experience they never turn out well.
I say, put in Rune, if the princess feels there's something amiss, I'll be glad to ride ahead and find out. I shall frankly rap on the gates and demand to know.
Nonsense, replied Fluda. I'm quite sure all is well.
A harp string broke and twanged loudly. The bard cleared his throat.
No, I'm not sure at all. Oh, bother it. The girl has put an idea in my head and I can't shake it out. One way everything looks all right. The other way, it looks all wrong. Just to ease your mind, my mind, that is, Fluda told the princess, I shall be the one to find out. As a wandering bard, I can go and come as I please. If anything's wrong, none will suspect me. If not, there's no harm done. Stay here, I'll be back directly. We shall laugh over this at King Smite's table, he added,
but without great assurance. The bard dismounted, considering it wiser not to draw attention by riding the Lian.
And you try no mischief, he warned Glue. I hate to let you out of my sight, but Lian will keep an eye on you. Hers are sharper than mine. So are her teeth.
On foot, the bard made his way to the castle. After a time, Ailanwy saw the gates swing open and Fluda disappear within. Then all was silent. By nightfall, the girl had grown seriously alarmed, for there had been no further sign from the bard. The companions had concealed themselves in a thicket, awaiting Fluda's return, but now Ailanwy rose and anxiously faced the castle.
"It is all wrong," she cried, taking an impatient stride forward.
King Rune drew her back.
"Perhaps not," he said. "Why, he'd have come back immediately to warn us if there was."
No doubt Smoyt's giving him supper, or... Rune loosened his sword in its sheath. I'll go and see.
No, you shall not, Ilanwy cried. I should have gone in the first place. Oh, I should have known better than to let myself be put off by anyone.
Rune, however, insisted. Ilanwy refused. The heated, although whispered, dispute that followed was interrupted by the sudden arrival of the bard himself. Breathless and gasping, he stumbled into the thicket.
"It's Mag! He has them all!"
Fluda's voice was pale as his face in the moonlight.
"Caught! Trapped!"
Ilanwy and Rune listened aghast at what Fluda had learned.
"The warriors themselves don't know who the prisoners are, only that there are four with Smoyt locked up for treachery. Treachery, indeed! They've been made to swallow some kind of tale. The game goes deeper than that. What it is, I couldn't discover. I think the guards had orders to lay hold of everybody entering the castle. Luckily, those orders didn't seem to apply to wandering bards. It's so usual for a bard to drift in and sing for his supper that the warriors never gave it a second thought, though they did keep an eye on me and wouldn't let me near Smoyt's great hall or the larder where they've put the prisoners. But I caught a glimpse of Mag. Oh, the sneering, smirking spider! If only I could have run him through then and there! The warriors kept me harping until I thought my fingers would drop off, he hurriedly concluded. Otherwise, I should have been back long ago. I didn't dare stop, or they'd have smelled a rat. And there's a rat to be smelled, he cried furiously.
How shall we rescue them? Ilanwy demanded. I don't care why they're locked up. Ask later. First get them out.
We can't,
Fluda answered in despair.
Impossible. Not with only four of us. And that's four counting Glue, who can't be counted at all.
Glue snorted. Usually the little man took no interest in anything not bearing directly on himself. Now his face was agitated.
When I was a giant, I could have torn the walls down.
Bother when you were a giant, snapped Fluda. You're not one now. Our only hope is to go farther into the Cantrev, tell one of the Cantrev lords what's happened, and have him rally an attack force.
It will take too long, cried Ilanwy. Oh, do be quiet, and let me think.
The girl strode again to the clearing, and turned her eyes defiantly toward the castle, which flung its own dark defiance against her. Her mind raced, but with no clear plan. With half a sob and half a cry of anger, she was about to turn away. A movement against a nearby tree caught her glance. She halted a moment, not daring to turn her head. From a corner of her eye, she grew aware of a strange, humped shadow, motionless now. As if to continue on her path, she walked seemingly in the direction of Fluda and Rune, but edged little by little toward the tree. Suddenly, quick as Lian, she leapt upon the humped figure. Part of it went rolling in one direction, and the rest of it set up a muffled shrieking. Ilanwy pummeled, kicked, and scratched. Fluda and King Rune were at her side in an instant. The bard seized one end of the flailing shape, King Rune the other. Ilanwy drew back and quickly took the bauble from her cloak. As she cupped it in her hand, the sphere began to glow. She held it closer to the struggling form. Her jaw dropped. The golden beams shone on a pale, wrinkled face with a long, drooping nose and mournful mouth. Wild wisps of cobweb-like hair floated above a pair of eyes that blinked wretchedly and tearfully.
"Gwistle!" Ilanwy cried. "Gwistle of the fair folk!"
The bard loosened his grasp. Gwistle sat up, rubbed his skinny arms, then climbed to his feet and pulled his cloak defensively about him.
"How nice to see you again,"
he mumbled.
"A pleasure, believe me. I've thought of you often. Goodbye. Now I really must be on my way."
"Help us," Ilanwy pleaded. "Gwistle, we beg you. Our companions are prisoned in Smoyt's castle."
Gwistle clapped his hands to his head. His face puckered miserably.
"Please, please," he moaned. "Don't shout. I'm not well. I'm not up to being shouted at this evening. and would you mind not shining that light in my eyes? No, no, it's really too much. It's more than enough to be pulled down and sat on, without people picking at you and bellowing and half-blinding you. As I was saying, yes, it's been delightful running into you. Of course I'll be glad to help. But perhaps another time, when we're not feeling so upset.
Quistel, don't you understand? Eilanmi cried. Have you been listening to me at all? Another time? You must help us now. Gwydion's sword is stolen. Durnwin is gone. Aron has it. Don't you see what that means? This is the most terrible thing that could ever happen. How can Gwydion get the sword back if he's locked up, with his own life in danger? And Taran, and Carl, and Gergi.
Some days are like that, Quistel sighed. And what's to be done about it? Nothing, alas, but hope things will brighten, which they very likely won't. But there you are, it's all one can do. Yes, I know Durnwin is stolen. A sad misfortune, a disheartening state of affairs.
You already know? Exclaimed the bard. Great Berlin, speak up. Where is it?
No idea whatever,
Quistel gasped in such desperation that Eilanmi believed the melancholy creature indeed spoke the truth.
But that's the least of my concerns. What's happening around Anuvin?
He shuddered and patted his pale forehead with a trembling hand.
The huntsmen are gathering. The cauldron-born have come out, whole troops of them. I've never seen so many cauldron-born altogether in my life. It's enough to make a decent person take to his bed. And that's not the half of it,
Quistel choked.
Some of the Cantrev lords are rallying their battle hosts, and their war leaders held council in Anuvin. The place is thick with warriors, inside, outside, wherever you look. I was even afraid they'd discover my tunnels and spy holes. These days, I'm the fair folk's only watcher close to Anuvin. More's the pity, for the work piles up so. Believe me,
Quistel hurried on,
your friends are better off where they are, much safer. No matter what's being done to them, it can't be worse than stumbling into that hornet's nest. If by chance you do see them again, give them all my fondest greetings. I'm sorry, terribly sorry, I can't stay longer. I'm on my way to the realm of the fair folk. King Idyleg should learn of these matters without delay.
If King Idyleg learns you wouldn't help us, Eilanmi indignantly burst out, you'll wish you'd never left your waypost.
It's a long, hard journey.
Quistel sighed and shook his cobwebby head, completely ignoring Eilanmi's remark.
I shall have to go above ground every step. Idyleg will want to know all that's stirring along the way. I'm not up to journeying, not in my condition, not in this weather, least of all. Summer would have been much more agreeable. But there's nothing to be done about that. Goodbye. Farewell. Always a pleasure.
Quistel stooped to pick up a bundle almost as large as himself. Eilanmi clutched him by the arm.
Oh, no, you don't, she cried. You'll warn King Idyleg after we free our companions. Don't try to deceive me, Quistel of the Fair Folk. You're cleverer than you care to let on. But if you won't give us your help, I know how to get it. I'll squeeze it out of you.
The girl made a movement to seize the creature about his neck. Quistel gave a heart-rending sob and feebly endeavoured to defend himself.
No squeezing! No, please! I couldn't face up to it! Not now! Goodbye! Really, this is hardly the moment!
Fluda, meanwhile, was staring curiously at the bundle. The large, lumpy pack had rolled near a bush when Eilanmi had first set upon Quistel, and it lay partly undone on the ground.
"Great Berlin," murmured the bard. "What a tangle of oddments! Worse than a snail with his household on his back!"
"It's nothing, nothing at all,"
Gwistel said hurriedly.
A few little comforts to ease the journey.
We might do better squeezing this pack instead of Gwistel's neck, remarked Fluda,
who had dropped to his knees and had begun to rummage through the bundle.
There may be something here more useful than Gwistel himself.
Take whatever you please,
Gwistel urged, as Ilanwi turned the bauble's glow upon the heap.
Have it all if you like. It makes no difference. I shall manage without it, painfully, but I shall manage.
King Roon knelt beside the bard, who thus far had pulled out a few mended sheepskin-lined jackets and several ragged cloaks.
Amazing, Roon cried. Here's a bird's nest.
Yes,
Gwistel sighed.
Take it. It's something I've been saving. You never know when the need for one might arise. But it's yours now.
No, thank you, muttered the bard. I shouldn't want to deprive you.
Their hasty search next revealed water flasks, both empty and full, a walking staff in jointed sections allowing it to be folded up, a cushion with an extra bag of feathers, two lengths of rope, some fishing lines and large hooks, two tents, a number of iron wedges and a crooked iron bar, a wide piece of soft leather, which, as Gwistel reluctantly explained, could be set about a willow frame to serve as a small boat, several large bunches of dried vegetables and herbs, and numerous bags of lichens in all colours.
For my condition,
Gwistel mumbled, indicating the latter.
The dampness and clamminess around Anuvin is dreadful. These don't help at all, but they're better than nothing. However, you're welcome.
The bard shook his head in despair.
Useless rubbish. We might borrow the ropes and fish hooks, but for whatever good they may do us.
Gwistel, Ilanwi cried angrily. All your tents and boats and walking staves won't answer. Oh, I could squeeze you anyway, for I'm out of patience with you. Begone. Yes, goodbye indeed.
Gwistel, heaving huge sighs of relief, rapidly began packing his bundle. As he hoisted it to his shoulder, from his cloak fell a small sack, which he tried desperately to recover.
I say, what's this? Asked Roon, who had already gathered up the bag and was about to hand it to the agitated creature.
Eggs,
mumbled Gwistel.
Lucky they weren't smashed when you took your tumble, said Roon cheerfully. Perhaps we'd better have a look, he added, untying the string around the mouth of the bag.
Eggs, said Fluda, brightening somewhat. I shouldn't mind eating one or two of them. I've had no food since midday. Those warriors kept me harping, but they took no pains to feed me. Come, old fellow, I'm starved enough to crack one now and swallow it raw.
No, no,
squealed Gwistel, snatching for the bag.
Don't do it. They're not eggs, not eggs at all.
I say, they surely look like it, remarked Roon, peering into the sack. If they aren't, then what are they?
Gwistel choked, then went into a fit of violent coughing and sighing before he answered.
Smoke!
He gasped. Chapter 6 A Clutch of Eggs.
Amazing! Cried King Roon. Smoke made of egg? Or is it egg made of smoke?
The smoke is inside!
Gwistel muttered, drawing his shabby cloak about him.
Goodbye. Crack the shell and the smoke comes out, in considerable quantity. Keep them, a gift. If you should ever see Lord Gwydion, warn him to shun Anuvin at all cost. For myself, I'm glad to leave the place behind me and hope never to return. Goodbye.
Gwistel, Ilanwi said sharply, gripping the melancholy creature's arm.
Something tells me there's more to that cloak of yours than meets the eye. What else have you hidden away? The truth now, or I promise you such squeezing.
Nothing!
Gwistel choked. Despite the chill wind, he had begun perspiring heavily. His cobwebby hair hung limp, and his brow dripped as if he had been caught in a downpour.
Nothing, that is. But a few little personal things of my own, odds and ends, if they interest you, by all means.
Gwistle raised his arms and spread his cloak on either side, a gesture which made him resemble a long-nosed and dismal bat. He sighed and groaned miserably, while the companion stared in surprise.
"Odd indeed," said Fluda. "And great Belin, there's no end of them."
Neatly attached within the folds of the cloak hung a dozen cloth sacks, mesh bags, and carefully wrapped packets. Most of them seemed to contain clutches of eggs, of the sort Fluda had narrowly avoided eating. Gwistle pulled off one of the mesh bags and handed it to Ailanwy.
"I say," exclaimed Rune, "first eggs, now mushrooms."
As far as the princess could see, the mesh bag held nothing more than a few large brown speckled toadstools, but Gwistle waved his arms desperately and moaned,
"Beware! Beware! Break them and they'll singe your hair off. They make a handsome puff of flame, if you should ever need such a thing. Take them all. I'm well pleased to be rid of them."
"It is what we need," Ailanwy cried. "Gwistle, forgive me for threatening to squeeze you."
She turned to the bard, who was examining the sacks with an air of uneasiness.
"Yes, these will help us. Now, if we can find a way into the castle." "My dear princess," replied Fluda, "a flam is dauntless, but I hardly think it practical overcoming a stronghold with little more than eggs and mushrooms in our hands, even eggs and mushrooms of this particular sort. And yet..."
He hesitated, then snapped his fingers.
"Great Belin, we might pull it off at that. Wait, I'm beginning to see the possibilities."
Gwistle, meantime, had unfastened the remaining packets from his voluminous cloak.
"Here,"
he sighed,
"since you have most of them, you might as well have the rest, all of it. Go on, it makes no difference to me now."
The packets which Gwistle held out in a trembling hand were filled with a quantity of what appeared to be dark, powdery earth.
"Put this on your feet, and no one can see your tracks. That is, if someone's looking for your tracks. That's really what it's for. But if you throw it into someone's eyes, they can't see anything at all, for a short while at least."
"Better and better," cried Fluda. "We'll have our friends out of the spider's clutches in no time. A daring deed. Clouds of smoke, billows of fire, blinding powder, and a flam to the rescue. That will give the bards something to sing about. Ah, tell me, old fellow," he added uneasily to Gwistle, "you're quite sure those mushrooms work?"
The companions hurriedly returned to the cover of the thicket to set their plans. Gwistle, after much coaxing and cajoling, as well as hints of further squeezing and suggestions of King Idyleg's displeasure, at last agreed, with many a racking sigh and moan, to help in the rescue. The bard was eager to begin immediately.
"In my long experience," Fluda said, "I've found it best to go at this kind of business head on. First, I shall return to the castle. Since the warriors know me, they'll open the gates without a second thought. Under my cloak, I'll have Gwistle's eggs and mushrooms. Directly the gates are open, clouds of smoke, a blast of fire, the rest of you will be lurking behind me in the shadows. At my signal, we all rush in, swords drawn, shouting at the top of our voices."
"Amazing," put in Rune. "It can't fail."
The King of Mona frowned.
"On the other hand, it would almost seem, not that I know anything about these matters, we'd be rushing into our own smoke and fire. I mean to say, the warriors couldn't see us, but neither could we see them."
Fluda shook his head in disagreement.
"Believe me, my friend, this is the best and quickest way. I've rescued more captives than I have fingers on my hands."
The harp tensed and shuddered, and a number of strings would have given way had not Fluda added in the same breath,
"Planned to rescue, that is. I have never, in strict point of fact, actually done so."
"Rune is right," Ailanwy declared. "It would be worse than stumbling over your own feet. Besides, we'd be risking everything at one go. No, we must have a better plan than that."
King Rune beamed, surprised and delighted that his words had found agreement. He blinked his pale blue eyes, grinned shyly, and ventured to raise his voice once more. "I suddenly think of the sea wall I've been rebuilding," he began in some hesitation.